American body absenteeism. The United States radically differs from the European context of individualism. Contrary to the bourgeois ideal of individualism, which rose from the French Revolution, and the unity of the sensorium, which dominated European social science in the latter part of the 19th century, somewhere along the line, the United States, the body part of the Cartesian matrix, the idealized physical image, got lost completely. This might account for the rather original view Alexis de Tocqueville maintained when he wrote on the philosophical method of the Americans in 1840 in his work Democracy in America. To tend to results without being bound to means and to strike through the form to the substance, such are the principal characteristics of what I shall call the philosophical method of the Americans. In most operations, the mind of each American appeals only to the individual effort of his own understanding. On the surface, indeed, it seems like the absence of a general body invites to refer to one's own understanding. But the reality of this statement is most likely more subtle. De Tocqueville suggests a highly individualized approach, but historical developments in the USA after his days rather reveal a search for identity, which was primarily contextually justified. One example of this can be found in the identity creation of the American Deep South. For instance, authority as a physical reverence in the traditional European feudal sense was missing in America. Nobility did not exist and could therefore not serve as a refutation or a confirmation of identity. In spite of the fact that Americans seem to have had an anti-colonial war, none of its characteristics show any features of other anti-colonial wars, which, in the 20th century, always contained the establishment of some socialistic elements, according to Barrington Moore, at least. Appealing to the individual effort of one's own understanding becomes quite in agreement with the contextual situation. An example of the Tocqueville can be found in the attitude of the Southern planters with regards to the abolition of slavery, as pursued by the North, and, as Barrington Moore explains, as industrial capitalism took more and more hold of the North, articulate Southerners looked about themselves to discover and emphasize whatever aristocratic and pre-industrial traits they could find in their own society: courtesy, grace, cultivation, the broad outlook versus the alleged money-grabbing outlook of the North. The Southern context enforced resorting to argumentation of the content for justification of the method. But as methods are always limited in their application, so are the thoughts on which they float, and true. Alexis de Tocqueville continued with, "The Americans do not read the works of Descartes because their social condition deters them from speculative studies, but they follow his maxims because the same social condition naturally disposes their minds to adopt them." The Cartesian matrix is, of course, present in American thinking just as much as anywhere else in the Western world. After all, it was not Descartes who was responsible for the body and mind split. It existed long before his writing, and it was adopted long after his writing. But in the absence of kings and queens, the body part of the matrix, its image, needed to be reconstructed as an ideal body again. This ideal of the American individual finds its roots in the Protestant image of ethics, in which the body is subjected to control by a larger community, a parochial one. And whether north, south, or even western frontier, according to Rupert Wilkinson, this American ideal urged firm beliefs in calculate your interest, work hard to improve, and raise yourself, and success will be yours. Norbert Wiley argues in his book, The Semiotic Self, that constituting the Declaration of Independence, as well as the Constitution, politicians already had this image of moral dignity in mind. This image consisted of an internal hierarchy, as Norbert Wiley explains. In the hierarchy of moral dignity, reason was the highest faculty, then interests, still rational but self-serving, and finally, the highly emotional passions. The properties of these faculties relied very much on the notion of human nature, differentiated by its reason from, of course, animals. And this reason shaped the body of the civil American. It also entailed faculties which were seen as the profile of the white male rather than any other human being in society. Neither did this ideal offer citizenship to Native Americans or African Americans, nor did it allow women to vote. And true, Barrington Moore too concludes that the American Civil War was not about the establishment of equal rights, but rather an economic capitalist revolution, establishing an economic guise for a system of fundamental equality. Control and authority shifted from a sense of inborn physical nobility, as existed in the old European countries, towards a sort of baptized, physically transformed body which owns its credibility of the white supremacy. Unlike the French Revolution, it did not result in a bourgeois ideal, but in a WASP ideal, a selection in which the discolored culture became the established parameter for financial security and restrained the body as a guarantee for credibility. In fact, as Max Weber noted in the early decades of the 20th century, the reliability of one's economic credit in the US rested on such parochial control. He notes that most of the captains of industry and trust magnates belonged formally to the Protestant sects, and though this does not entirely result from an economic opportunism, Weber notes, yet one must never overlook that without universal diffusion of these qualities and principles of a methodological way of life, qualities which were maintained through these religious community, capitalism today, even in America, would not be what it is. This accounts for the somewhat slightly different view which was held by James Fenimore Cooper, less known as Alexis de Tocqueville, but almost simultaneously published his work. In The American Democrat, published in 1869, Cooper expresses a social critique which seems to coincide with the strange disembodiment of Descartes, as mentioned by de Tocqueville, but with a slightly different view. As de Tocqueville believes that Americans, under the conditions of their colonial migration, have resorted to themselves as the source of all truth, saying, they commonly seek for the sources of truth in themselves or in those like themselves. Fenimore Cooper believes exactly the opposite, explaining, they say is the monarch of this country in a social sense. No one asks who says it, so long as it is believed that they say it, designing men and devir to persuade the public that already they say what these designing men wish to be said, and the public is only too much disposed blindly to join the cry of they say. According to Cooper, somewhere along the line, the American colonists lost track of their history and connection with the early European monarchs. as well as with the parochial nature of European societies, especially in England. And he explains the historical condition as: men have been so long accustomed to see oppression exercised in the name of the one, the Queen, or in the name of a few, the Republic, that they have got to consider the sway of numbers as the only criterion of freedom. Numbers, however, may oppress as well as one, or a few, and when such oppression occurs, it usually is one of the worst character. Therein lies the disembodiment of the American philosophical method, I think, as it appears on the scene as an intentional world, as a system of reason, without a historical background, and through this physical amputation of Queens, Republics, and Descartes, it seems able to claim universality. Democracy appears to be without history in the American view, and in this sense it stands for reason, for only if reason had no history could it, by means of itself, justify its claim to universality and demonstrate that it is anything more than the means by which we justify the lies we tell, according to Steven Tyler. And the suggestion of a democratic method without history at least make democracy appear as democracy. This loss of history overshadowing the appearance of democracy is also one of the major issues of social critique in the United States today. There is no country in the world where the one versus the many, or the one, the few, and the many, are such a dominating topic as in the United States. This continuous pluralization of individuals has led to an almost invisible authority behind the screens, which seems to be a reification of the condition of they say, which Cooper pointed out. The suggestion of the United States as a classless society has contributed to this idea. Gore Vidal, for instance, writes: the few who control the many, through opinion, have simply made themselves invisible. They have convinced us that we are a classless society in which anyone can make it. It has also completely degenerated the difference between the public and private spheres. The difference between both is continuously undermined by either the benefit of the public or individual freedom and the pursuit of happiness. The third party involved, the one that got away, so to speak, seems to be rooted in the dynamics of the process whereby queens, kings, and dictators have been abandoned and condemned, but monotheism nevertheless rules. Gore Vidal considers this phenomena the root of all evil. The United States is a nation under God, but not under man. In fact, the old monarchs of Europe ruled in the name of God. Replacing monarchic structures in America did not implicate the replacement of monotheism, which still is as strong as the parochial control of the days of Alexis de Tocqueville and Fenimore Cooper. As Max Weber noted, the strong separation between the church and state, as existed in the United States from the beginning, also implied that neither the one nor the other institution could be questioned about their mutual moral implications. And because of this, neither authority nor hierarchy can be traced to its original existence, much less its concrete existence anymore. State and religion are officially separated, but ideologically interconnected by means of their monotheistic ground roots, as well as their Protestant ethics. Both have become a metaphysical condition in which political and academic circles seem to have constructed an opposition between the individual and society, which never really existed, but simultaneously becomes totalized in the relation between individuals to an inherent competition in the quest for happiness. The totalization within American society is much more dominant as the organic structure of any type of relation between individual and society, or as Steven Tyler explained in a lecture at Northwestern University in Chicago. This opposition between the multis and the unis is not reducible to the older discourse of agnostic opposition between individuals and community, or between individual rights and the common good. Even to call it a tension between multis and unis is to fall back into a discourse of these older oppositions, for it is no longer a tension in the sense of opposition between localization and totalization, but a tension within totalization that have co-opted the model of dispersed power and now use it as their own means for their own purposes. Such disembodiments of power has led not to democracy of the American nation, but to a reification of the system, as well as an immense fragmentation of anything which can be called culture or even habitus, like Bourdieu meant, in its original sense. Though also in Europe academic spheres, the entire apparatus of disciplines has encouraged the use of words to represent wholes. In the United States, this has reached its utmost metaphysical level. The exchange rate between unfoundational fragments like culture, political economy, psychology and sociology into presumed wholes construct words as self-referential reifications. It might not be that modern society is sick, but its reification certainly is, according to Wolf. And the United States of America at least seems to have become a reification of itself. Its politics of democracy and other reification fights the imposition of a federal government because of its reification, but it seems to have completely abandoned the social ramifications of its members. The federal state itself has become an almost metaphysical mind. In America, on the other hand, and quite on the contrary, points towards a lack of control by the governmental body over its members. This is not the result of a society without classes or individual freedom, but rather the result of a society without a society, a mind without a body, so to speak, or rather a mind for control and a body without a separate identity. Most authors agree that the social cause of it all is to be found in 100 years of labor migration, of cities being built as workplaces and factories rather than as habitats. The landscape seems to be the only spatial history, a habitat which is either inscribed by the monuments of nationalism or national pride, or by traces of ancient, mostly wiped out cultures. With a few exceptions, American cities cannot be called cities, but more resemble air-conditioned workplaces spread out, way up or way out, with rigid Protestant working hours, whether or not the climate allows it. No walking culture, hardly any street life. Americans themselves cannot be easily grasped within their society, as they simply do not stay in one place long enough to become fully observed by the system. If they are confronted with the incapacity to express themselves freely, most of the time they simply leave or withdraw or take up therapy. And therefore, finding what can and cannot be expressed freely in the United States of America is one of the most difficult undertakings one can imagine. The inexpressible has been vastly covered up under the realms of public lives and private politics. In the anxiety of making a living, maintaining a living, and rising above the realms of anonymity, or submerging into silent protest, to enterprise or to be enterprised, that is the question. America maintains a consensus which is more static, more imposing, and less concrete than any other society in the world. In such a context, American are forced to withdraw into the enclaves of their families, either that or leave them altogether. In short, they do not touch each other socially unless it is absolutely necessary, meaning unless it cannot be avoided, as it would lead into temptation. Any turnabout, or at least such is the general fear, could lead to an excessive degree of anything, and as such is the cultural experience. Americans themselves tend to believe that their rigid and distancing touching behavior is part of the leftovers of European society. I think, however, that it, in spite of the prejudices about the alleged affectionate superficiality of Americans, it is a result of a society which still entails parochial control over the private spheres of life. These private spheres of life, as they are invaded by public control, have an immediate effect on the rules of displaying affection. On the one hand, the display of affection is under constant threat of being interpreted as a sex act. On the other hand, the display of affection means opening up, with all the consequences of the private space being under threat of invasion by public spheres or, worse, judgment. Cor Vidal says, "After all, in the first world, monotheism is weak. Where it is weak or non-existent, private sexual behavior has nothing at all to do with those not involved, much less with the law." Indeed, the concept of sin, sense, and its danger of acceleration into sodomy has virtually been destroyed in Europe around the turn of the century, partly as a result from the separation between state and church, which resulted in the implementation of the French Code Penal. The Penal Code brought about changes in legislation and jurisprudence, which separated private and public spheres of life, though not without intense social structure. In the United States, however, it was never challenged. People are still considered beastly unless restrained, and this restraint coincided with the taming of the American Wild West, which in turn coincided and produced a counter-movement of the concept of self-protection against other beasts, by means of firearms if necessary. The general fear for limitless excessiveness is met with as many limits as possible. Limits gyrolling into space, one overcompensating the other, as hyperventilating bodies. It is not surprising then that the United States can be seen as the birthmark of cyberspace, according to Tyler, which seems to be the far growth of reaching beyond the boundaries of anybody's imagination, and in which absent spirit have been recreated to boldly go where no one has gone before, in an attempt to leave behind every philosophical tradition, but never succeeded in actually doing so. Partly because that would take deeds, in the Goethean sense of the word, rather than words and computers. But deeds, in the United States, convey for Americans a fear of consequences, of even more invasion of privacy. It is neither surprising then that Edward Sapir has been labeled as a romanticist, even an evolutionist. His celebration of genuine culture has at times been viewed as a return to the native or the pre-industrial concept of individuality. I, for one, am amazed at how many Americans still maintain their core of social feeling, their genuine culture, under the pressure of such vast amounts of industrialist and post-industrialist mechanism. Partly, I think, this maintenance of the genuine is the result of a resistance. Whatever pops up in American culture as genius usually has developed from a counterpoint, a silent protest which appears as an act of craziness at first sight. Where social deeds are concerned, there is a compelling necessity for every social act by Americans to be a voluntary one, and which so much dictatorship by economic reification It seems to be, at least in the eyes of many, the only way to survive while simultaneously maintaining the myth of democracy in America. Sapir tried to salvage from American culture whatever he could. In fact, he took anthropology to the limits of what it is able to accomplish. All of his work, much which has been republished in the Mandelbaum collection, breathes an urge to balance relationships within American society. And though Alexis de Tocqueville is viewed as a prophet, almost able to predict the future of American society, Sapir painfully predicted what would be missing in the future of American society. Time, that is. Time to experience culture in its genuine sense. Lack of time to engage in communication. Time pressure for money. Time pressure for work. Time pressure which eventually constructs passive citizens from the former wildlife. In the stream of time, the movement has created endless images of what individuals should be like. Since the establishment of the ideal image of the American citizenship, at least it seems American, have discovered ways of enforcing images of individuals to battle among each other. Books appear in large quantities about the American individual, all battling each other over the right interpretation of the American character. For Christopher Lash in The American Culture, it has resulted in narcissism. For Rupert Wilkinson, it is dominated by fear. As a counter-movement against direct involvement, America invented political correctness as a means of oppression, more effective than any name-calling. It means, as long as we, or you, or I, do not name things in accordance with our prejudices, we will not change and everything can remain exactly the way it is. Indeed, it is a plurification within a totalization, as Steven Tyler points out. It has enabled pluralized categories to oppress those individuals they seem to defend. In the ridiculing political acts of the American gay movement, individuals have been forced to come out of the closet, brought out into the public against their will. At the same time, African-American political movements appear who are more oppressive to black women than any white supremacist could ever accomplish. And even some feminist groups spread rumors about fatal reaction of independent women who, as a result of their emancipation, are not likely to engage in partnership. They are advised to be emancipated in public life, but submissive in private relations. I know these are harsh words, but American identity groups constantly invade and rule people's private lives. Whether they like it or not, it seems Americans are all forced to become individuals of one type or another. But whether politically correct or not, the multiplication of the plurality of individualism does not serve the support of the venture of its finest capacity, which is, after all, social and not plural. Sapir said it. If we do not thus value the nuclei of consciousness from which all science, all art, all history, all culture have flowed as a symbolic byproduct in the humble but intensely urgent business of establishing meaningful relationship between the social, actual human beings, we commit personal suicide. However, I do not want to be blinded by the idea that socially aimed tendencies, as well as their symbolic byproducts, meet with ends so easily. If the mere value of the nuclei of consensus would be enough, so many Americans would not suffer the consequences. So where is America's cultural history, and how much of it is determined by distant bodies and body distances? For there can be no doubt that with every social attraction there has to be some form of eroticism to enable the process of actually meeting on equal terms. And Sapir's sense of harmony might not lead into such temptation. My feeling is that this temptation needs more genuine approach in the United States than anywhere else in the world. Its accessibility might not be one of a socio-scientific nature. If anything allows for mixed categories or escapes the linear sequence of a rationalized text, it could be poetry and music. And indeed, very strange things have happened with American poets like Ezra Pound or Walt Whitman. Their history, as well as their politicalization, painfully stakes out that harmony is impossible in the United States under the reign of a parochial control dominating societies. Individuals hardly have room to breathe in the United States. They either become pluralized by group identities or are reduced to archetypes. Maybe Ezra Pound sheds some light into the darkness of an ahistorical America, and maybe Walt Whitman has something else to convey than the discourse of homosexuality. Both poets have crystallized the central key towards America's internal conflict, which constructs crisis of the individual bodily expression in tradition, history, and representation. And how about Sapir's poetry? Sapir himself did not believe the world to be a happy place as he wrote his poem. I have no respect for what is. I cannot mend and patch. I cannot bend my soul to the twist that will make it fit with the brutal fact, that will make it yield to the tyrant world. My soul stands firm. It would annihilate all in its range and build anew rather than bend. And therefore it breaks, and the brutal fact remains, and the tyrant world wags on. It seems strange that Sapir viewed the English Elizabethan tradition as one of a culture possessing harmonic tendencies. It might be that the romantic poetic capacities of the Elizabethan age could maintain Sapir's belief for a humanistic approach in cultural anthropology, as well as his urge for genuine personal comradeship, an urge he shared with Whitman, and maybe with Pound as well. Totalization seems to be devised by the queens and kings of humanism only. To build anew? As much as they destroy the body images of the past and the present.